the owner of Yuck Yucks called my house, and I was still a kid at the time living at home, and I wasn't home. And so he spoke to my mom and said, "You better tell Jeff, you better cancel his show," and started threatening my mother. And I remember thinking, oh, I don't want to work for these people.
Not working for those people was probably one of the best career moves that Jeff Rothpan, one of the busiest comedy writers in LA, ever made. Jeff was a teenager at the time, a teenager with a dream to become a professional comedian. The difference between Jeff Rothpan and thousands of teenagers who dream of a life in comedy is that Jeff had the comedy chops, the work ethic, and the ability to learn from his mistakes to make it happen. His story is coming up on The Inadequate Life. Hey, it's Keith Tomasek. Thank you so much for taking the time to listen to my podcast, The Inadequate Life, a podcast about the creative process and people whose lives depend upon it. As always, I'm recording right here from my swanky suburban basement spare room. I got a little hot cup of Darjeeling tea going. Of course, it's from my sponsor, Karen Hartwick, over at Stratford Tea Leaves. Book a tea tasting or drop by to experience the world's best, freshest, and most exotic loose leaf teas with Karen Hartwick. She's Canada's tea sommelier, and you can order online. Just visit stratfordtealeaves.com. You can order online or give her a call. She's got some of the best and freshest teas. You'll love it. I do. Hey, it's just a few days before Christmas. How about that? New Year's? Have you made a resolution? I always made a resolution when I was a kid. Not so much anymore. And I usually stuck to them too. Speaking of being a kid, at age 16, my guest, Jeff Rothpan, made a resolution that he wanted to be a comedian. And before his 24th birthday, he appeared on The Tonight Show with Jay Leno, his first of six appearances. These days, Jeff is one of the busiest comedy writers in LA, working on TV shows, films, providing material for Jeff Dunham. Hey, incidentally, since 2008, and I looked this up, since 2008, Forbes magazine has consistently ranked Jeff Dunham as one of the top grossing comedians in the United States. You look it up, it's true. And if you look at the list, you'll see Jerry Seinfeld's probably the only other name that consistently ranks so high on that list. My buddy, Jeff Rothpan, works with and for Jeff Dunham. And for Jeff Rothpan, it all began at a small club in Montreal. So I kind of met you the first time I was operating the sound at a comedy club in downtown Montreal on Crescent Street. It was Ernie Butler's club. And you came in as a young guy. You were like a teenager back then, weren't you?
That is correct. I was I was 16 years old. And I knew then, I figured if I tried it at that point and did okay with comedy, if I started now, then maybe in a few years, I'd be way ahead of everybody else who started in comedy.
Everyone knew, the first couple of times we saw you, we were like, this guy is amazing. You were just, you shone right away for sure.
Oh, thank you. I had a lot of energy, nervous energy, I'm sure, to make up for the lack of material because
that's funny.
I had original thoughts and ideas, but I was too afraid to present them. And so I was sort of watch other comedians and just sort of do almost, what they call like hacky things that I knew worked with the audience. And that's how I kind of started, was just doing goofy bits. And I even tried to be a little bit like Steve Martin at that time. Maybe a year later, I was trying to be more like Jay Leno at the time.
That's funny. And we were lucky being in Montreal because Just for Laughs was around. So we'd get the well-known comedians. But in terms of the crew, like just the crew before you that I kind of grew up with were people like Howard Buskang, Howard Nemitz, Mark Blutman, who are all hugely successful producers and writers in L.A. Do you know any of those folks at all? Were they around when you were around?
They were ahead of me, I guess you could say, right, in the next class.
Yeah, they're all doing super well. But the guy who was around Hemingway's with Ernie Butler and then over at the Comedy Nest when you were there was Stevie Ray Fromstein. Do you remember Stevie Ray Fromstein?
Oh, yeah, very well. And in fact, my dad used to drive him. We'd pick him up and give him a ride. But I started with him and then lost touch with him until many, many years later. I think we met maybe a few years ago at the Winnipeg Comedy Festival.
Sure.
And we were both doing a show there together. And he had become a very successful writer, producer, I believe at Roseanne and some other big
That's right. Oh, very successful.
Yeah.
How did you leave? Because you were doing really well in the Canadian comedy scene, touring, doing clubs. But you obviously had a goal. I want to make it. What was the first step out of Canada?
Well, the first step was, I wasn't sure. I mean, I knew eventually I'd want to go to the United States, and I thought, well, I guess that's where you have to go if you really want to, you know, do well and all that. But I would have been just as happy staying there if I could have gotten my own show and all that. But what kind of helped was that I got people at Yuck Yucks upset with me because I played an opposing club. Yuck Yucks, I was just starting to get in with them. Even though they were in Toronto, I was going to start maybe getting booked in their clubs. But then they found out I was playing another club in Ottawa that was not a Yuck Yucks. And so the owner of Yuck Yucks called my house, and I was still a kid at the time living at home, and I wasn't home. And so he spoke to my mom and said, "You better tell Jeff, you better cancel his show," and started threatening my mother. And I remember thinking, oh, I don't want to work for these people. I have to get out of Canada and just, you know, skip the whole Yuck Yucks thing and the whole touring thing here and try to get to the States.
Oh my gosh, that might have been one of the smartest decisions you made at such an early point in you're still a teenager, right?
Oh yeah. The fact that he yelled at my mom, like, I just thought, oh, I don't want to work for these people.
So Mark Breslin, basically the guy who champions the fact that he's developed and built comedy in Canada, yeah, actually drove one of our own away.
Yeah, pretty much. He had scared me at that time. So I just thought, oh boy, this is crazy. I don't want to be, I'm getting threats here. I think I was maybe 17 at the time.
And your 18. Poor mom.
Yeah, my mom was scared. She said, "You better call Yuck Yucks. They said they're going to, you know,
wow,
stop all work, you know, that you have in Canada." And I said, "What?" And so that's when I thought, okay, how else can I get, how else can I do well in this business without them? And I thought, well, I better move to the States somehow. And that, so I started to make that my goal. Then once I got into the festival and did a gala, I met many agents and producers, people from big networks like NBC, and they would say, come out to LA because you're going to do well. And so I got a lot of encouragement, and I was told by Bud Friedman, who owned the Improv Comedy Club,
sure,
in LA, to come out. He'd put me on. And so that was it. That's all I needed to hear from all these people. And I moved to LA like soon after that. And the thing was, when I got out to LA, some of these people either forgot what they told me. I would call them up, and some remembered, and some would have me in for meetings, and they would say, "Okay, well, thanks for coming in to meet with us. We'll let you know if anything comes up."
I just left my home, my family, and everybody, and you basically have forgotten them. You're just putting me on a nice courtesy call. Thank you.
Right.
How old are you at the time?
You know what? I was 22, just turning 23. And so I got out to LA, and I did. And Bud Friedman, who told me he'd put me on at all his clubs, he had totally forgotten. He had seen me in Montreal and told me how much he liked me there and that he would put me on. And so he had me audition for him in LA, and it didn't go well. It was about 1 a.m. It was hard. It was like 10 people. They were drunk. And
you always hear that story. Now, didn't you have a manager, or are you working without a manager at this point?
I was working on my own, although I did sign with, it was one of these sleazy manager situations.
Jeez.
Where I did meet with somebody who said they'd help me, and turned out to be not a very good manager or connected person. So all of a sudden I was starting to panic, and I had some cousins from Montreal who moved out there who owned some Ben and Jerry's franchise stores. And so, believe it or not, I was starting to panic, and I asked them if I could possibly start doing some work for them. And scooping ice cream. So here I was at the Montreal Comedy Festival doing and I was being shot for television there, and I was being, there were news reports and stuff about my career. You know, he's on his way to the United States. He's moving to LA. The Montreal Gazette wrote a whole story about how he's making it.
And scooping ice cream in Los Angeles.
Next thing I know, I'm up to my shoulders in ice cream. I have chocolate arms from scooping ice cream, and it didn't go well there, by the way. My own cousins, they had to fire me. I don't blame them, but.
Oh, no. You can't make it at Ben and Jerry's.
Couldn't even make it as a scooper. And I thought, oh, this is bad. And my poor wife, I had also gotten married at a very young age, and my poor wife comes out here with me, and I'm telling her, oh, this is, we got it made. And luckily she was working and very supportive, but oh my, it was like, at the very beginning I thought, what have I done? Well, I may have made a big mistake. So that's what happened when I first got out there. And I didn't really tell that many people, of course, what happened, probably till now. So
that's, oh no, I didn't know that. Okay. But But as I talk to creative people, there's two things I get over and over again. One is the ones who are successful, like yourself, they say, I didn't have a plan B, because if I had a plan B, it would have been too easy just to get out of being creative and doing that every day as my job and going into plan B. Mm-hmm. Or they have the story that you have where they kind of hit rock bottom and they were like, oh my God, yeah, this is really serious, right? So did you think maybe you'd go back to Montreal, or did you think I'm going to stay in LA?
Well, at that point we had moved. And I decided to just keep going, and I kept knocking on doors. I even went back to Bud Friedman, who said, where my audition did not go well in LA. He said, well, call me in 6 months and I'll audition you again. Well, I just called him a week later and he totally forgot, that he had seen me, and said, yeah, we'll go. Let me put you on next week. I remember you from the Montreal Comedy Festival, but he had forgotten that I bombed like a week at his club. And so he put me on again, and this one went a lot better. And next thing I knew, somebody from the improv, they had a TV show at the time called Evening
of Improv. Course.
So luckily after that show, they planned a date, to put me on one of their tapings, maybe a month or two down the road. And I thought, oh great, I can't believe this. I'm booked for an actual little TV appearance.
But how, sorry to interrupt, sure, but at this point, it doesn't sound like you're making a lot of money, because at least in Canada, you could tour and do feature or middles. Are you making money at this in LA, or still struggling?
Yeah, still struggling. It was luckily my wife was working, and I did have savings from the work I did when I was stand up in Canada, because I lived at home, so I was able to save.
Right.
So yeah, I mean, we were just getting by. At the time, we didn't live far from the Comedy and Magic Club, which is a place in Hermosa Beach, California, not far from LA, but it's closer to the beach areas, and it's a great club where Leno works out every week, and he still may even work there every week, every Sunday. And I knew that. So I thought, well, let me try and get into this club. Maybe I could meet him down the road. And they did get some big names. So like I'd go into these clubs and just try to, you know, and I didn't get paid necessarily. I don't know if I did, it was very little. And yeah, so it was just persistence and not giving up. But it felt like I had started everything over when I first got out to LA.
Man. And then in how long? So here, did you actually bump into Jay Leno then at the Comedy Magic Club in Hermosa?
And that's, yeah, exactly. So my little fantasy almost worked out. It just sort of worked out in a way, because I knew he had worked there, and I thought, well, let me keep trying to get into this club. And that club, they put me on for a couple of audition spots. And because I lived not far from that club at the time, I was a good go-to when somebody dropped out at the last minute or they needed a replacement for a host.
Proximity has value.
Oh boy, sure enough. Maybe a year after I had started, you know, getting persistent and not giving up and all that stuff, I had worked there from a Tuesday to Saturday with another headliner, and they said, hey, you know, Leno's coming in tomorrow, and we realized his opening acts are not there with him tomorrow. Can you just do an extra night? Well, I'm like, of course. So open for Leno. And I went up, and somebody introduced me, and I did my 10 minutes, I guess it was. And I came off stage, and Jay Leno was back there in the backstage area saying, hey, you know what? You'd be perfect for the Tonight Show. Because I kept it clean and funny, I guess. And I had a good set, and I couldn't believe it. I just walked off, and there he was telling me how good it was, and I'd be good for the Tonight Show. And I said, oh, great. Well, of course, I'd love to do it, and thank you. And he said, yeah, just call the office, and we'll put a, we'll get you a date.
Just to interrupt, you know what I love about this story, Jeff, is even I remember back when I met you when you were 16 at Hemingway's there in Montreal, is you were just a can-do kind of guy. So some people might have showed up, in Los Angeles, and they've gotten burned by Bud Freeman not remembering and saying, oh yeah, we'll get you here, and then turned around and got bitter. And then when Leno says, hey, we'll get you on the, you're like, yeah, sure. But you didn't give up, I love that.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. I at the time I felt I had no choice. I'd probably give up now that I'm older. Now that I'm older, I'm like, all right, we're out of here. But it's funny. At the time, I felt like I had no choice. We had made.
But it didn't. You didn't turn. You know what I'm talking about? These guys who have been around who are quickly turned bitter.
Oh sure.
So now you're waiting for the phone to ring, or what's this story? This is kind of. I'd love the story though. So now you think, maybe I'm going to get on the Tonight Show, although it's just begun.
It's just begun, and I thought, maybe he means it's in a 6 months or a year or something, and they'll start working with me on a kind of a 5 minute routine set or whatever you call it. And so he just said, call the office. And I said, okay, great, thanks. I didn't even ask him for the number to this office.
Call the office.
I didn't know what office he was talking about.
But that's beautiful.
I assumed it was at NBC. But
you don't even go, what's the number? You go, okay, no problem.
I just had stars in my eyes going, I can't believe this worked out. I just can't believe it. I walked off. Just it was all so surreal. And I did stick around and watch his show. And it was amazing. He was just, he's just amazing at what he does.
I got to see him in Montreal at Club Soda. And I've never laughed so hard so quickly. Oh. It was just, he is a master.
I think I was there. I might have been there. He remembers, by the way, he has an incredible memory. He remembers Club Soda from Montreal. So here he was getting ready to take over the Tonight Show, told me I'd be on and he'll get me on at some point. And I just couldn't believe it. So I just was so excited, went back to my apartment, told my wife, I said, eventually, I guess I'm going to be on the Tonight Show. I have to figure out where this office is though. I don't know who to call. And, but luckily, he called me himself.
Wow.
And my wife saw me on the phone, and I guess I turned white because I heard, yeah, Jeff's Jay Leno. I'm like, really? I couldn't believe it. I almost thought it was a friend of mine playing a prank, and I guess I turned white and started sweating or something. And my wife was going, what's wrong? Are you okay? And she's talking to me while I'm on with Jay Leno, and I'm just trying to wave her away from me.
Oh, no.
Get away, yeah. Get away. And it was Jay Leno again, just saying, yeah, I just want to tell you, you'd be great for the Tonight Show, and I want to get you on. And so I'm going to have you get together with Jimmy Brogan. He was one of Leno's head writers at the Tonight Show, who was a comedian himself. And the funny part about that was I ended up calling Jimmy. I had to look him up in the phone book. He said, yeah, give Jimmy a call. So there's another one. He said, yeah, he just said, call Jimmy. And luckily, we had phone books at the time, not as many cell phones at the time.
Yeah.
And called him, at his home and said, yeah, Jay Leno told me to give you a call about seeing my Tonight Show set. He said, he did?
Oh, no. Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's as if Jimmy had found out he was getting the job.
Oh, no. Yeah. How did I draw the short straw here?
He goes, I have to do what? I said,
I have to do what?
Jay said, you're supposed to watch my Tonight Show set and help me make this 5 minutes, put this 5 minutes together for the Tonight Show. And he said, oh, okay. Well, I'm performing tomorrow night. You want to just come down there and see if you can get on?
Oh, there you go. It's so casual.
Yeah, wow. It wasn't like this with the last booker on the Tonight Show, but the last booker would just call a comedy club and say, put Jeff on for 5 minutes. I want to see him.
So that's amazing, though. So you go to, and how, yeah, I haven't talked to you at all about your process. So in the time between getting your elbows full of, Ben and Jerry's ice cream and then working regularly at Hermosa, how were you keeping track of your material? Were you talking into, were you recording your sets? Were you writing things down? What was your process for keeping your bits?
I was recording. Everybody was using these little tape recorders at the time, and they'd leave them at the back of the room or maybe bring it on stage with you.
And were you transcribing what you'd record and actually writing up by hand in books, or what did it actually look like, your work?
Oh, I almost did it. I did write stuff down. I wrote new bits down, and the old stuff I just kept. It's funny. I had a good memory at the time for knowing what worked, and I'm like, oh, wow, I came up with a new line that worked on stage, and I would remember it for the next time. And it was basically the going up all the time really helps. I would tell any new comedian that the most important thing, besides writing, would be going up as much as possible, which you probably hear from other comedians all the time.
And you just a minute ago, you said you kind of made an allusion to the fact that now you're less likely to remember stuff. So did there come a point in your career as a comedian where you thought, I'm kind of losing stuff, I better start keeping track of this?
Oh, if you don't go up as much, like when I became, when I started to make my living as a writer more than a comedian, I definitely forgot stuff because, you have to constantly be doing comedy, to be very polished, and you'll forget stuff after just being off for a week.
So you finally get your first, so you work out with Brogan, he goes over the material.
Yeah.
You're backstage at the Tonight Show. What was, and you're how old? 23?
So 23, yeah. After, and I think, yeah, it was probably just a year ago, I was scooping ice cream or, thinking that was my career. And so the whole thing was just so surreal. And it's a lot quieter at the Tonight Show than it seems on TV. TV, it's very loud, but because they don't want to have sound, I guess, reverberating in the studio, and it's for TV, everything's a lot quieter. So I barely heard them say my name, barely heard Jay Leno say my name, and the curtain opened and I walked out, and it just was so surreal. And luckily I worked on it for maybe a few weeks with Jimmy. Like I did And he was, like I said, surprised to know he had that job of, you know, working with the comedians to put them on. And so I was able to get on just about everywhere and just keep working on that 5 minutes. And once I was a backstage at the Tonight Show, it was a good thing because that I had worked on it so much, because the muscle memory was probably what got me through that, because I was so freaked out walking out on, you know, stage, knowing it was going to be on TV. And so I was definitely nervous. I started to enjoy it once I heard laughter out there, but I was definitely a nervous wreck before that. But like I said, I had practiced it so much that I almost couldn't forget it. That's always everyone's biggest fear, of course. You walk out and you forget things. And they will give you, they'll hold up a cue card with maybe some points, some note form points of your act if you need it.
And you're the first one to talk about muscle memory in terms of being a comedian, which I love, because that's a term we associate with music and we associate that with athleticism. But that's a really, really interesting point. And not just your teeth and your tongue and your lips, but your whole body, because, you know, the body is so much of the delivery and the performance. That's fascinating.
Oh, yeah. It was like, yeah, it's funny. Stand-up comedy, to me, it's almost like what a magician does. Like, you're putting on this little illusion that this is like a normal, you know, conversation that we're having between it's one person on stage and a whole audience, which is, it's very unnatural when you first start.
Yeah.
It's like, oh my God, why am I talking to these people?
Hey, and who were the guests on the show their first night? Who was out there on the show?
We had Jason Alexander and Seinfeld, I guess, was one of the hottest shows
of
the time. So he was on. There was actually another Canadian, a singer named Tom Cochran.
Life is a highway. Was that when Cars? Maybe Cars was a big hit or something?
Actually, Life was a Highway. That's when it was. That was the big hit song, Life is a Highway. Who else was on? Oh, Danny Glover.
Oh, yeah.
Actor Danny Glover, who was doing the movies with Mel Gibson. And am I allowed to curse on this? But he said,
Just
said, you're a funny motherfucker at the end, as we were walking off the stage and everything. And anyway, it was all so surreal. And then it was back to my little apartment. To watch the show with my wife.
Jeez.
Yeah, it was so bizarre. And it's so funny. My mother, it wasn't enough for my mom. It turned out she called up and said, well, did they give you a sitcom? What's next?
Oh, no.
I'm like, well, I just did The Tonight Show. What else do you want?
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm sure that explains why I got into comedy in the first place. But that'll be another show.
Oh, I hear your mother. Okay, when is the sitcom? So when did you make the shift from being a club guy to being more of a writer? Because that's like a huge transformation to make.
Oh, yeah. And it's weird. You go from being treated almost like a star and like, you know, a real artist performer. And writer is almost like a regular day job. In a way. So it was a lot less glamorous, but I had been, even after the Tonight Shows, I started, all it was leading to, at least in my case, was getting more road work. I was getting a lot of road work from the Tonight Shows, and people were booking me, hoping I'd mention the name of their club on the show. And,
Wow.
We'll be playing Hee Hees and, you know, and Cedar Rapids. I was sort of maybe losing my creative spark on the road. I didn't feel like writing new stuff either, because I'd be working in these clubs that were, you know, filled with people who had been drinking, and they don't care to hear like really smart stuff. They just want to hear, you know, dick jokes, pardon the expression.
But,
and a lot of these places. And so I would try out new, it was very hard to try out new stuff in these clubs. And
then all of a sudden you're working for guys working at Soft Cedars. And like you said, you can actually feel a whole different sort of pride there.
Jeff even started playing hockey arenas. He became so popular and still is. He's still playing these huge places where they have hockey games.
It blows me away. He's playing in London, my hometown. He's playing in Hamilton. I just looked. He's basically almost sold out. And let's talk a bit about – I got to tell you, Jeff Dunham, I teach a class at the Western University. I'm not teaching right now, but I taught a social media class. And one of the lessons was about what's a viral video. So, go back. At the beginning of the class, I'd say – McLuhan has this theory that all media tends to really just repeat itself. And I'd say, you know, radio really stole from vaudeville. So a lot of the vaudeville acts ended up on radio. And I'd explain to them about Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy, this ventriloquist who was popular on radio in the 30s or 40s. And the students would be like, can you imagine a ventriloquist on radio? That seems absurd. And then I'd say, okay, let's take a look at the top 10 viral videos in terms of how quickly their numbers grew in the shortest period of time. And Jeff Dunham, was there with Ahmed the Dead Terrorist, right. And I'd say, you see, it's history repeating itself.
There you go.
It's a ventriloquist on YouTube, but it's good and it's funny. And, and so I loved bringing that up. And of course, the students loved because they all knew Jeff Dunham, but I had no idea at the time that you were writing that. So that's, congrats to you and Jeff for making, you know, making that whole, bringing back ventriloquism in a way.
Thank you. Yeah, and it's weird. He, that clip actually helped, give him a more of an international audience, like almost overnight. And, I don't think he expected that. It was, he had a pretty good following and, was really popular in comedy clubs. But when that one hit, it was all of a sudden my manager would say, hey, and I was working on another TV show at the time, actually just writing sketches, for a comedian named Frank Caliendo who does impressions. And he had his own little TV show and I was working on that. And they said, you're going to have to leave that show. Jeff's going to need you like full time.
Wow.
Like, full time. Really?
And that was when YouTube was still breaking. So I bet there were, you know, Russell Peters was another guy who I was flying. This is like 8-9 years ago, flying from Toronto to Dubai. And there was a kid, with the traditional headscarf on and he had his mobile phone looking at Russell Peters. And I stopped him and I thought, okay, this is traveling. So same thing with Russell. And of course, and then, and you ended up doing the show. I just watched it on DVD, Jeff Dunham, Oliver, the Map, where were part of the tour going across to 5 continents.
Oh God, that was crazy. Cause I don't really travel with Jeff. I usually just email all the stuff in and he tries it out. And I used to tour with him a little bit when we first started, but he realized I was just emailing him the stuff in the hotel. And he said, well, you may as well just stay at home and I can save all the money from taking you along.
He's emailing him the stuff in the hotel. I love that.
So he was getting all his material by email anyway, so he just left me at home. But yeah.
That's hilarious.
But yeah, this tour was a whole different deal because they were going to make it into a special and they were going to film us going around and maybe show they were thinking of showing us doing some writing, although even on this tour, I was still emailing him all the stuff.
Well, but the nice thing about the tour is every country that he goes to, so whether he was in Ireland or whether he was in Israel or whether he was in the United Arab Emirates or Malaysia, he'd do almost 20 minutes, it seemed like, of local material. So I've got to ask you questions because in the DVD and the show, he mentions that he felt weird doing comedy for non-native English language speakers. But he felt, I can deliver the material, but Dunham said he was concerned there'd be a delay while the audience was trying to interpret the joke. So did you have to adjust your comedy writing specifically to address audiences where English was not their first language?
Well, you know, we didn't worry about it too much because we just figured, well, Jeff can't, you know, do any other languages. So he figured that the fans better come in to see him know enough English or they just like him regardless, because the characters are just funny characters. Sometimes their mannerisms are just funny to people in those countries. I didn't really worry about the language. We just tried to do, we wrote material, or I wrote material with, there were a couple of other writers that were brought in. Sometimes we bring in other writers to help contribute more volume.
Right. Yeah.
So all I did was worry about writing material about that country. Maybe a few, you know, sort of not too, we didn't go too harsh with the insults, but we'd make fun of the country a little bit and the crowd usually laughed. And so, and I'd write last minute things that night, as right before the show sometimes. And Jeff would put it into kind of a little teleprompter that he had for where he could see the new material because it was so hard to remember all this new stuff for each country.
Yeah, because you're doing it night after night. Yeah. Flying around. One of my favorite bits was Ahmed the Dead Terrorist whistling Hava Nagila Hava to a Jewish crowd in Israel.
Right. So, yeah, and that was actually Jeff just came up with that on stage. So there is a lot of stuff that he does just improvising off the top of his head, and he's great at it. So.
And how tense was it in Abu Dhabi? Because it was a smaller crowd, and he was a bit nervous about doing Ahmed the Dead Terrorist.
Right.
In a Muslim country.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, that whole area, even, you know, both Israel and United Emirates, we didn't know how Ahmed would go over. Were they going to hate him or was he a hero? And it's funny. They all liked him, and maybe they for different reasons. I don't know. But they all laughed at it, and he was like a big hero in each place. Yeah. It was just Jeff, you know, we were getting all philosophical going, wow, it's laughter really does bring us all together. It's all, if only the world realized that we all laugh at the same stuff.
It's totally true, though. And Ahmed the Dead Terrorist is bringing the world together. Who would have thought?
Yeah, it's exactly what happened. And it seemed that way anyway. Everybody was laughing at him in both countries. And
no, it's a great DVD. And I had a lot of fun watching you sleeping at different road stops.
Yeah, there were. there was a lot, you know, they just edited that thing down. I never know what they're going to show. I mean,
of course,
I was doing a lot more than they ended up showing, but
They also showed you with in South Africa with a bunch of lions that looked kind of scary. Were you actually afraid there?
I was afraid. I didn't think I was going to, I thought they were going to just shoot Jeff doing that, Jeff Dunham, and not me and anyone else on the crew, but they invited all of us to come in and, oh man, it was just an amazing experience to be with these little lion cubs. And then we got to be with bigger lions later on. They call it the walk with the lions, and you walk with them and they have these guys who are like throwing meat as you walk with them. And the lions go for the meat. They don't go for you. But they have, of course, you're worried if they're going to run out of meat. But they were throwing, I think, some meat as we walked with the lions down for this sunset. So it was a beautiful, wild experience.
Yeah, once in a lifetime sort of thing.
Oh, yeah. So yeah, I have to thank Jeff for that, for wanting me along. They also thought it would be funny because they knew I hate travel. So
well, that was the line that I don't know if you wrote it about yourself, but wasn't the furthest this guy's ever been from his home is his mailbox?
Right. Yeah, it's an exaggeration, but not far off. Yeah. So I mean it was the whole reason I changed my career. I couldn't take doing stand-up because I just could not even take the travel just to go to Chicago
and having to stay in those bloody bed and breakfasts.
Right.
Sorry. I can't resist.
No, I was getting all my material was coming basically from there. All the new material was just all coming about. Yeah, it was all being about travel.
And how much do you miss? How much do you miss not being on stage? Do you miss that at all?
At first I didn't because I had done it for so long, but now I still get an occasional itch and I still get asked occasionally to do it. The only thing is I don't remember a lot of the stuff. I have stuff written down, but yeah, it's hard for me to go up with and just be very smooth.
Wow. Okay. Well, Jeff, thanks so much for taking the time. I'm going to go out and see. I hope to get to see Jeff Dunham when he gets to London here. I was in a bar actually with a buddy of mine talking, and I was telling my buddy, I said, "Oh, I'm interviewing a comedian who writes for Jeff Dunham," and the waitress was like, "Oh, I love Jeff Dunham. She saw him last time he was through at the hockey rink, and she was like in the nosebleed sections, and she said she was so far, but they have the big screens, and she said how much fun it was."
Great. Oh yeah, it's a fun. He puts on it's a big show, and he's the Springsteen of ventriloquism. He just puts on a great show. He wants to make sure everybody goes home really happy, and he does a lot of different types of material and he'll do some old stuff that people want to see again and again, and then some. And he always has new stuff in the show too that we're always working on. So
cool. Well, that must be fun. And anyway, so thanks for taking the time from
you
your swinging pad in LA. Oh no. Not at all. We got to do it again. And I might be in LA at some point. I'll drop by and say, I'm just inviting myself over, by the way.
As long as you don't mind the dog.
No. Hey, cool. Thanks so much, Jeff.
You bet, Keith. Thank you again for having me.
Well, there you go. That's my old pal from Montreal, Jeff Rothpan. You can see him and his comedy on the DVD he and I discussed All Over the Map at jeffdunham.com. My thanks to Jeff Rothpan, of course, former Montrealer like me, world traveler like me, and a hardworking man. Ah, geez, I really got to make a New Year's resolution. But I can tell you what's happening in the new year on the show. Comedy improviser and originally from Calgary, Rebecca Northern, whose show Blind Date has appeared off-Broadway and at London's West End, she's going to be on the podcast, as will Chelina Kennedy, star of the Broadway hit Beautiful, the Carole King musical. Don't miss these great episodes. Just subscribe on iTunes. It's easy. Search the iTunes store for The Inadequate Life, then hit subscribe. That way, you'll never miss an episode. That's The Inadequate Life, a podcast about the creative process and people whose lives depend upon it. I'm Keith Tomasek. Thanks for listening.